This podcast is from the Overnights program on ABC Local Radio. I'm Brad McKenzie. Now, joining us shortly is Tom Gilling. He's the author of 14 books, including several works of true crime and memoirs co-written with musicians Kate Sobrano and Troy Cassadaly. His first novel, The Suitakin, was critically acclaimed and named a New York Times notable book back in 2000. He's teamed up with former police detective Clive Small to co-author several best-selling crime novels, including Smack Express, Blood Money, Betrayed, Malat, Inside Australia's Biggest Manhunt, and Evil Life, the true story of the Calabrian Mafia in Australia. Now, Smack Express formed the basis of the TV series of Underbelly, The Tale of Two Cities. His most recent book is Grog, A Bottled History of Australia's First 30 Years. And we've got him on the line this morning. Good morning to you, Tom.
Good morning, Brad.
That's quite an impressive resume. Congratulations.
Yes, I must say I hadn't counted 14 myself, but I'll take your word for it.
Well done. Now, just before we get into Grog, A Bottled History of Australia's First 30 Years, what do you enjoy more, fiction or non-fiction?
I prefer fiction, actually. I love writing fiction, but it's a tough market to crack, so you have to do a bit of non-fiction as well, I think. True crime is always a popular genre to write in, so that's why I tend to come back to that.
So from the outside, I guess with fiction, you can be stuck for hours, days, years, or just it come to you and then you've got to follow it. A fresh idea for a book, whereas a non-fiction, you've got facts, but you can't afford to get them wrong either, can you? So I guess it's a fine line, whichever way you go.
That's true. I think if it's a day when you're slightly lacking inspiration, then non-fiction is something that, yeah, you can fall back on the information that you've got. I think you need the muse a bit more maybe when you're writing fiction.
Very true. So where does this fit in among all the other books you've written? What was the impetus? Why this book?
Well, I was reading Robert Hughes's brilliant The Fatal Shore once, and I read this comment he'd written that between 1790 and 1820, nearly all the men and most of the women were addicted to rum. And I thought, could that be really true? I mean, Hughes is a great writer, and that was a terrific book. And what you're saying about facts is absolutely true. But could all those things be reconciled? And I wondered if they could. So I was interested to do a bit more research on that subject, because those 30 years that Hughes was talking about actually represented a phenomenal growth in the colony of New South Wales. And it seemed unimaginable that they could have done that if they were all drunk.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. So you know, and then starting to read some of the sources that Hughes had used himself and some others, I started to think, well, there's definitely a very different story coming out here.
So can we draw a parallel with the binge drinking that we have today, or perceived binge drinking, and that of the late 1700s and early 1800s? Was it, you know, pro rata against the amount of people there? Was it pretty horrific, the grog that was getting consumed?
Yeah, I don't think it was horrific. It was certainly horrific to some. It was horrific to the authorities in New South Wales, and it was horrific to the authorities in London, and it was certainly horrific to those who had who were business rivals of the colony, like those who would have preferred to keep the convicts at home in a prison. But it was actually quite fairly consistent with drinking in Britain at the same time. I think there was a lot of politics involved in that representation of the colony as a place that was perpetually drunk.
I've got an interesting text here from David in Rockingham, who asked me to ask you, can you tell us when the colonial governments realised the need to offer incentives to skilled brewers to come to the colonies? Somewhere along the way, people were dying from deadly rot gut gin that any fool could distill in a bathtub. He once lived in South Hobart near the Cascade Brewery, and apparently, according to him, Peter de Graves was given a land grant to found the brewery. Is that correct?
Look, I don't know about Peter de Graves, but I think that's quite possible, because certainly from the very start, the governors began to see the damage that was being caused by strong drink, and especially stuff coming in from overseas. And they were keen to encourage the drinking of either beer or of wine. So it was in the interests of the governors to try and set up local industries for both of those, because obviously beer didn't travel and wine was not much better. So certainly there was an official push to try and establish both those industries and to try and wean the colonists off the heavy stuff.
Amazing. Now, is it true that the First Fleet refused to sail without alcohol?
Almost. I mean, the Marines in the First Fleet, like the other Marines in the Royal Navy, were promised a certain amount of grog every day. And the rumour began to go around before the fleet set sail that the New South Wales Marines would have their rum supply, their grog supply, cut off after they landed in New South Wales, whereas the rest of the Royal Navy, the sailors who were on the ships would continue to get it. And at that point, the Marines said they wouldn't go. They were all volunteers, and they said they weren't going to go under those terms. So Arthur Phillip, who had an awful lot on his plate in those last couple of months before the fleet sailed, had to suddenly turn around and get an assurance from the government that allowance would continue at least for 3 years.
Was he a good leader, Phillip?
Phillip, I think he was a great leader. I think he was a very humane man. And it's hard to imagine how anyone could have done a better job. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't have his critics, because a lot of people hated his guts. But when you read his account of what he did and other people's account of what he did, I think he was an extremely competent and just a deeply humane man, a man who was very conscious of the kind of problems that were likely to arise with the Aboriginal people, and did his best to try and reconcile those and try to develop friendly relations with the local inhabitants.
Now, do you think, would we be a different country, or would that first 30 years or so, would that have been different if it hadn't have been the English that had settled here first?
You know, it would have been the French who had just a few kilometres down the road in Botany Bay.
Yeah.
I'm sure we would, but I'm sure there are lots of... I think can be a long bro to try and look at our identity now with our identity then, or the identity of the people who settled the country. But I think you could look at... it's an interesting way to look at things. And if you look, for example, at the way Arthur Phillip ran the colony, he had the same provisions as everyone else. He was very specific about that. So when people complained about the amount of food when the colony was starving, which it often was, he would say, I'm well aware of that. Don't lecture me about that, because I see it every day at my own table. And so there's something about... we like to think of Australia as an egalitarian kind of place, and I think there is a certain truth to that. And perhaps part of it goes back to that idea that... even the worst of times in the late 18th century, the governor there was only allowing himself what the simplest convict was eating.
Did that change with the change in governor? Not the food, obviously, but alcohol and our reliance on it. I mean, there was a stage, was there, that it was almost being used as a currency, or whether it was black market currency or...
Yeah, absolutely. It was usually, I think it's probably most accurate to say it was barter. The idea of a currency depends how you define it, but currencies tend to go circulating round and round the society, whereas grog tend to circulate very briefly and then got drunk. But it certainly was used to pay convicts. Certainly a lot of the convicts in those days, they were working to develop private land in basically as overtime in their own time. And a lot of them were certainly saying they would work for grog, but for nothing else.
It's interesting you say that, because I can't tell you the amount of work that I've had done around the house when it's a small job, you know, with a slab of beer, which the taxation department frown on, because obviously there's no GST. You've got to send another half dozen as GST. But so it still goes on, doesn't it? We've still got that tradition, I guess.
It does, yeah. I think it's still an appealing form of payment for some people.
Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. How are you going?
Very well. You'd like to have a chat to Tom about the Rum Rebellion.
Yes. Wouldn't the Rum Rebellion be considered to be the beginning of organised crime in Australia? Because in those days, rum was a currency, and Captain John MacArthur had his own still, and that's why it was confiscated, because he was virtually printing his own money. And the thing about it is, Captain John MacArthur was the first Conservative in Australia, and the whole thing has continued on from there, I reckon.
Oh, that's a fair point. Yeah, I mean the whole New South Wales Corps, the army then was steeped in it. It was they ran the importation of it and of grog, and so they were largely those responsible for distributing it around the colony.
Well, the whole campaign against Governor Bligh was extremely poisonous. And actually, when MacArthur went to London to plead his case, he was actually given the snub and told to go home.
But, he was.
He was actually snubbed and told to go home. You know, the thing is that in England, they wouldn't actually cop his poisonous approach. But the thing about it was he had a campaign against Bligh, and Bligh was actually toppled by him.
That's quite right, but I think the British government certainly didn't want MacArthur lurking around London for too long and being tried there, because a lot of skeletons would come out of closets. But Bligh, of course, was an extremely unpopular man anyway. So I think you could certainly look at as the start of organised crime in a sense, but. Bligh was such an unpleasant man.
He had a reputation from the Bounty Mutiny, but the thing about it is this, as far as the Bounty Mutinies were concerned, he was probably no worse than any other British naval captain. The thing about it is, as a governor of New South Wales, apparently he was a very, very fair man. The thing is, you know, he might have been unpopular, but the unpopularity was actually created by MacArthur's poison.
He was seen by some to be very fair, but he created very opposing opinions, and he was certainly very self-interested. I mean, you didn't have to dig too far into what he was doing to see that there was a bit of self-interest there as well.
Thanks very much, Alan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Interesting insight there that linking it back to organised crime in Australia. But
yes.
You know, fundamentally, organised crime doesn't have to involve, you know, warring tribes from, you know, overseas countries, does it? It does make a lot of sense.
Well, if you're talking about organised crime as a syndicate that's bringing in prohibited substances, then you could have nailed it there. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, is it true that there was a hospital built in Sydney by private contractors that was pretty much in exchange for the monopoly on the rum trade?
That's right. Well, the Macquarie, like all the governors before him, had received royal instructions when he came out here, and at the top of those instructions for all of them was get a grip on the rum trade. No sooner had Macquarie essentially decided to... He wanted to actually free up the trade, because he thought it would be less damaging if it was brought in freely but taxed by the government. Lots of governments, of course, have thought this way, than if he just let the Rum Corps bring it in as a monopoly. But no sooner had he done that than he actually, realising that the colony was in desperate need of a big hospital, he actually signed up another monopoly with members of the New South Wales Rum, with the New South Wales Corps and others, to actually build the hospital in return for a monopoly on the importation of rum for a few years.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's really not that much different now. Not necessarily
right.
rum and hospitals, but
the government in London, of course, was horrified, but the trouble that was in those days that it took so long for a message to go from Sydney to London and then to get a reply back from London to Sydney, that by the time London realised what Macquarie had done, it was already established. He'd already signed the contract, and there were ships already heading for Sydney from all over the world expecting to be able to land their trade, their grog freely, and they found that suddenly there was a monopoly in place again.
Was part of the issue the fact, I mean, apart from the distance involved, but the people in England really had no idea what was going on here until it was too late?
Look, I think that once again, if you look at who's providing the information, you see that a lot of them have an interest in the sort of story they're telling. So the bad press that that New South Wales was getting was frequently from people who hated the governor or
right.
disliked the administration or had some alternative business interest. So, for example, the clergy tended to write back some pretty negative accounts of the industry in which of the colony in which the place was full of drunks and debauchery. And Jeremy Bentham, who had a rival system, which was the Panopticon, which was a new model prison, he was very keen for the British government to actually start using the Panopticon. So he wrote some very strong diatribes against the colony, but he was a business rival, so he would. So I think there was plenty of grim aspects to the colony, but I think it's important to see who is giving those negative accounts of it.
So two-part question here. The first is, as a writer, do you sift through that and make your own value judgment on where you're sourcing that from?
Well, I think you need to be, you need to be aware of whether someone is pushing their own barrow here.
Yeah.
So, for example, David Collins, who was the first judge advocate, which is the senior legal officer, he wrote two volumes, which was very popular and sensational in London when it was published, in which he described the place as being largely drunk and debauched. So it's full of stories of drunkenness and of crime caused by drunkenness. But if you then looked at, Watkin Tench's two volumes account, you could search his entire two volumes for the word drunkenness, and you wouldn't find it at all.
Hmm.
So he was a very perceptive writer and commentator and observer of what was going on, and he didn't mention it. So let's not say it didn't happen, but if he felt that it was not a significant or the most significant part of the colony's existence, that's why he didn't write about it. Whereas, there are two fascinating accounts of the early years there, and they're both very divergent on the subject of grog.
Now, the Panopticon, that was the jail that was pretty much 360 degrees around the guards. Is that right? Because, from my understanding, once people came to Australia, they pretty much, well, they didn't have a free rein, but you know. It was pretty much an open jail, really, wasn't it? Because they weren't going to go anywhere. But this Panopticon, that I can't remember the name of the gentleman you were talking about.
Bentham.
So that would virtually become a jail in a jail. Is that correct?
That's quite correct. Yeah. In fact, there's still the remnants of one down in Hobart at Port Arthur. It's a creepy building to walk around, I must say. But yes, that's the idea. It was universal surveillance, basically. So there was no and sensory deprivation as well. They weren't allowed to talk to each other. They weren't even allowed to look at each other sometimes because they had to wear hoods. Of course, when the convicts first came out here, they couldn't. The administration, the government, could not afford for them simply to be in prison because they had to build the place.
Mm.
They arrived. They had nothing but tents. So the idea of a prison where all they were was confined simply wasn't viable. They had to work. So Bentham's system represented a totally different principle of punishment.
And so it was worth it for him to play up, I guess, on what was actually happening and letting the people in to say, well, this is lawless and you really need a jail that people can't get in and out of to keep your country under control.
Exactly, and grog to him was actually the centre of the whole argument. He wrote in a long letter. He wrote about the failings of the colony. He wrote that drunkenness in the colony was universal, and in the Panopticon was impossible. So he clearly saw that that grog was the fount of all evil.
Amazing. So, from your research. Did crime? You're putting a whole lot of criminals together anyway. That was the whole reason that they were leaving England was to come here because they'd broken the law. So initially, you've got a whole group of criminals there. Did alcohol fuel more crime, or do you think it was pretty much what we had in England just transferred to here?
Well, it certainly did fuel some crime, isn't it? There's no, it's not difficult to find incidents where either where grog led to sort of in a sense provoked crime in the form of theft. There's plenty of attempts to steal grog in those early years, and there is certainly plenty of accounts of violence committed by people who were drunk. But whether or not you could describe that as a wave of grog fueled crime, I think is another matter. Given that statistically it was not so different from the crime figures and the drinking figures in Britain, I think that would be falling into the trap of taking as true those who had a very prejudiced account of the colony.
Mm. And why? Well, this is going to sound ridiculous. It's no different to now, I suppose. Why were people drinking? Was it that bleak, the circumstances they were facing, and this is the only outlet they had?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, really, I think if you or I had come out there then, and you can try and cast your mind back to the kind of life and the kind of prospects that a lot of these people had, there were very few ways of escaping the discomfort and the ugliness and the disappointment of their existence, and after all, then as now, that's the reason why a lot of people drink, is to escape the real world.
As far as like British colonies in Australia, and they also set British colonies in the US as well, did they have the same sort of issue? I mean, it might be away from what you were researching, but did they have the same sort of issue in other colonies that the British set up in other countries?
Well, I think all around the world, all around the British Empire, there was a healthy trade in grog, and a lot of that grog, a lot of the grog that came to New South Wales, a lot of the, as you say, the rotgut, came directly from America, and so there was certainly a trade in grog that was going on with America. And yes, but the convict system in New South Wales only grew up in the first place because the American Revolution meant that Britain could no longer ship its convicts to America. So some of the issues that existed in New South Wales undoubtedly existed in the Americas as well. But some were different in interesting ways, like, for example, the loss of life in taking convicts across the Atlantic, which was a relatively short journey by comparison with bringing them to New South Wales, the loss of life was far greater taking them to America than it was under people like Arthur Phillip in bringing them all the way to New South Wales.
Okay, so now the main we've been concentrating on rum. Why rum? Is there something particularly easy about brewing rum, or?
Well, I think it was part of the Royal Navy culture,
right,
that the sailors had been the sailors had what would seem to us now as mind-blowing amounts of grog allowed them every day, a pint of rum they would get as an allowance. But it was really when Admiral Vernon, who was known as Grog because of his grogram coat, which was a kind of woolen substance.
There you go.
And he saw how drunk so many of the Royal Navy sailors were, and realised that you couldn't run a navy like that. Couldn't run an effective navy like that. And so he insisted on having it watered down and mixed with sugar and lime juice. And that was where the name grog came in. But the point being, anyway, that there was already a big rum culture and a rum economy. And it was a lot of Royal Navy people coming to New South Wales, so clearly there was rum here from the beginning.
And was that for everybody? I mean, did the learned gentry drink rum as well as the convicts, or was there a difference between the alcohol that was being consumed?
I think there probably was. If you read the accounts of their visits to places like the Canary Islands and Rio, then certainly the officers were out scouting for decent wine and brandy rather than drinking grog. The trouble is they were out of season sometimes, so the vintage had just been consumed by the time they arrived, so sometimes they were forced to drink some pretty ordinary stuff as well. But their instincts were certainly to look for something better.
And When did wine, it's a little away from what you talk about, but when did wine become, we bought people out, didn't we, specifically to start wineries, but obviously they would have struggled close to Sydney, but was that true that people came out, and when did that all happen?
It is, yeah. Well, Governor King heard word that, he was effectively told that two Frenchmen were coming out. There were two Frenchmen who were in a prisoner of war ship, because England was at war with France for a period then, two Frenchmen were prisoners of war in a hulk off Plymouth, and Portsmouth, they let it be known that they were pretty hotshot winemakers, and if the British cared to release them and bring them out to New South Wales, then for a modest annual salary, they were prepared to build a wine industry here.
Oh, fantastic.
So the British government fell for these shonky Frenchmen. They brought them out, and it very quickly became clear to those on site in New South Wales that they did not have the skills they claimed to have. That went nowhere. One left very quickly, and the other did stay, and he made a bit of peach cider, but the wine industry did not grow from those two fellows.
That is fantastic. It's great to know that there's people were still pulling the wool back then.
Yes.
Gillian's got an interesting question for us. Good morning, Gillian.
Hello.
How are you this morning?
I wondered whether the Aborigines had access to this grog as well.
Governor Phillip was very keen to keep grog away from all his own convicts, and very quickly, I suppose it became, the Aborigines, almost all of them, did not like it. They didn't trust it. They spat it out. They were offered it, certainly. But it was only one, Bennelong, who actually had a bit of a taste for the stuff. But most of them most of the Aborigines who did taste it, didn't like it, but it wasn't very long into the colony's life before some Aborigines started to be given it, as they were in other parts of in the American colonies and elsewhere, and it became became something to trade with, and you started to see the kind of results that were predictable for people who'd never encountered that before. So poor old Bennelong in the end was mocked as a drunk, and I certainly things started then.
Well, thank you very much, Gillian. Mr. Kay has a question for you as well. Mr. Kay.
Hey, guys.
Well, your question was?
Yeah, well, it's not so much a question, it's just to be fair on the convicts of the day. A lot of those guys didn't commit heinous crimes. Some of us just were stealing bread.
Oh, of course, yes.
Their family, you know, and they were actually brought over here, over to Australia, in other parts of the world, as not so much slave labour, but to develop the land. Alcohol was a really good thing. And there was rum, there was whiskey, they even brewed their own beer, and there was also the opium stuff. You know, they used to call it laudanum in the day, which was the cough mixture. And then when the Chinese came over, it just went rampant. And as far as the indigenous people go, when they weren't allowed to drink because, like the guy says, they really hated it. Back in New Zealand, they used to call it waipiro, which is rotten water. And they didn't have a taste for it until later on and years ahead. As far as Indigenous people go, we're still evolving when it comes to alcohol. When I say that, the white guys have been drinking for thousands of years, and Indigenous people worldwide have just started drinking in the last 200-300 years. We can't handle our grog.
That's a good point.
But at the same time, we love drinking because, like the guy says, it gets you away from reality.
It's a very fine point that you make, Mr. Kay. So opium, apart from alcohol, were drugs prolific back then, or was it purely alcohol as far as you're aware, Tom?
Alcohol is I would say, yeah. I haven't read anything about opium being available here, but In those days, alcohol certainly was very effective by itself, so and very hard to get, even though it was part of a huge economy. So, yeah, I think the drug culture came later.
Now, when did beer become a thing?
Very early, because as we were talking about earlier, the governors were keen to get the convicts to and the settlers themselves, the private settlers as well, to drink beer rather than to drink grog for another reason, which was that obviously the colony depended very much on its wheat. But a lot of that, the most valuable way for a farmer to sell his wheat was actually not for wheat to the government storehouses, but for wheat to distill into grog. And that actually threatened the colony's wheat supply for a while. Sorry, what was the question again?
So when did beer become a thing?
So beer was very, would be, if they could build up a beer industry, that would alleviate that problem as well. So very early on, the first brewer, James Squire, actually came out with the first fleet. He was a chicken thief, and it was only a decade or so after the colony started where he began to tentative experiments in brewing beer. And once he'd learnt how to cultivate hops in New South Wales, that was really when the industry took off.
Yeah, you think back, you know, to the way it's all run now. I mean, great, okay, we're going to have beer, okay, but we don't have wheat yet, all right, so we're going to have to grow wheat, and we don't have hops, okay, so we're going to have to grow hops. So there was, I guess it was hand in hand, wasn't it? As you say, we had wheat because it needed to be grown, and then the beer came, or was it the other way around? We want to have beer, so we're going to have to start growing wheat.
Well, beer was brought out on the fleet as well, because beer was was popular with the sailors, but it didn't tend to last long, and it tended to be drunk in such extraordinary quantities by the sailors and others that it wasn't very many weeks into the voyage where the beer would run dry. But even Captain Cook found that that water became so foul on board the Navy ships that one way of actually still being able to drink the stuff was to turn it into beer. So it was fermented with molasses and turpentine, if you can believe it. That was a way of actually enabling the stinking water to be drunk.
Gee whiz, so stinking water or something with molasses. It must have been very stinking water if something with molasses and turpentine in it was the more attractive proposition.
Absolutely, yes.
Dear, oh dear. So do you think that first 30 years has shaped the way we are now? Was there any sort of a time when it didn't become popular that you know the government went, oh, hang on a minute, we've really unleashed the beast here, now we've got to try and rein it back in? Is there a time that you can pinpoint that happened?
Well, I think there's always, in many different cultures, there has been a tussle between those who want the free availability of alcohol and those who want to prohibit it. And we don't only need to look at American prohibition there, but there's certainly the ACT. Even alcohol was forbidden there for a while. That was a dry territory for a while, and places like Griffith in New South Wales, when Griffith began to be settled in the early 20th century with a lot of Italians coming out to be fruit growers, that was a dry colony, the Murrumbidgee irrigation area. So I think there's always this tension between prohibition and free allowance, and that's happened throughout Australia's history, but it's also happened throughout international history that prohibition just very rarely works. There were certainly Governor Phillip did his damnedest to try and keep grog out of the hands of convicts, but he couldn't stop it falling into the hands of convicts, and nor could he prevent the government in Britain from seeing the possibilities, the commercial possibilities that might be available by taxing something that was as valued and as valuable as grog.
I've got a text here from Peter from Melbourne saying one of the reasons it was rum was because was part of a British three-way colonial trading system, slaves to the West Indies, rum for the West Indies, and tobacco from Virginia.
Correct. Yes, the rum from the two main sources of rum coming in were from India and from America, and that was largely from the West Indies, which of course was a British colony, and where a lot of the where the sugar was grown for the rum.
When was licensing introduced, and how did that affect what was going on?
Well, once it had sort of become clear to governors of New South Wales that it was impossible to actually prevent grog from circulating in the colony, there were attempts to control it by licensing. So licensing it came in quite early. Hunter and King both dabbled with the idea of licenses. But that involved fines for those who sold grog unlicensed, and undoubtedly then a legitimate grog trade did grow up. But there was always sly grogging as well. So there were plenty of illegal illegal stills being found even at the time when they were licensing the legal dealers.
And an impost was placed on? Was it a hefty licensing fee, or was it?
It wasn't a hugely heavy fee, but there was a pretty heavy penalty for being caught selling it unlicensed. But in one of the rich ironies that seemed to abound in these early years on the subject of grog, any constable who found someone who was an unlicensed seller of beer or someone who had an illegal still was often paid in grog. So the government on the one hand was trying to cut it out, and on the other hand was rewarding those who found it with grog.
Yeah, right, and usually taken from the still that
out the back. Yes.
Oh dear. Do you look at us now? I mean, we're there's a fine balance now, I guess, with the laws that we have in place for things. Do you think we've advanced at all as far as it goes, or are we still pretty much like we were back in the late 1700s?
Oh, I think we've advanced in the quality of grog available. I've no doubt that I would rather be drinking the stuff I could buy down at the local than be drinking beer made of molasses and turpentine.
Yeah, just to cover
but I'm sure it's possible.
Water.
Yeah, but I'm sure you can see continuities in those founding years of the colony, and you can look at how that influenced contemporary values, and as well as simply the industry itself.
We've got an interesting text here from Rob from North Queensland, who asks, and it's not perhaps not a question for you, but for everybody: are we too reliant on including drinks for most celebrations in an Australian way of life nowadays? It seems to be that everybody's got a drink in their hand, you know, while they're out enjoying other people's company.
I remember talking to a doctor friend once who was. Who drank a bit herself, and she was very much in favour of the health benefits of drink that of a modest amount of drink, which tends to make us more relaxed and less stressed. I mean, it's a stressful world, and a modest amount to enable people to relax from stresses of work and other things actually can be quite beneficial, even if, you know, just from a health point of view. I think it's the out of control binge drinking clearly that is more damaging.
Yes, no, it is, and you just hope that it's not a rite of passage, but you hope it hasn't. People aren't justifying it. But, oh, they did it 100 years ago, so 200 years ago, so no, it's all right. We can do that now.
Yes, I think the hardship they were escaping from in those days was possibly a bit greater than most of us face now.
Yeah, very true. Very true indeed. We've been chatting to Tom Gilling. He's the author of 14 books, including several works of true crime and fiction and non-fiction. His book, A Bottle History of Australia's First 30 Years, it's out in all the good bookstores now. So if you want an interesting read on the history of alcohol or grog in Australia, and I love, if nothing else this morning, we have found out where the term grog came from a coat. And a mix to water rum down so it wasn't as strong. So at least when you're at a dinner party, you can throw that on the table. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Tom.
You're very welcome,
Brett. Extremely interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, Brett.